Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, President Bush delivered his final State of the Union address, still singing from the hymnal he came in with.
If any bill raises taxes, reaches my desk, I will veto it.
Ronald Reagan wrote that song 20 years ago. He was giving his own last State of the Union with his last message.
Not everything has been made perfect in 7 years, nor will it be made perfect in 7 times 70 years. But before us, this year and beyond, are great prospects for the cause of peace and world freedom.
George W. Bush came into office modeling hard on Ronald Reagan. He was called Reagan's heir, Reagan's son. Now their legacies are beginning to be compared. It's no bed of roses for Bush. This hour, On Point, two presidents, two legacies, George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan. Joining me now are a father and son team that has been thinking a lot about the Bush legacy and how it squares or doesn't with that of Ronald Reagan. Joining me from Santa Barbara, California, is Lou Cannon. He covered the White House for the Washington Post and has written several biographies of Reagan. Lou Cannon, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Washington, Lou's son, Carl Cannon, former White House correspondent for the National Journal, now Washington Bureau Chief for Reader's Digest. They are co-authors of the new book, Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy. Carl Cannon, thank you very much for being here.
I'm glad to do it.
Carl, first to you. A lot of people may be thinking about President Bush's legacy today after his last State of the Union address last night. You and your father, Lou Cannon, clearly set out well in advance of that address to address this question. What are you up to here in this book, in this comparison?
Well, Ronald Reagan is the iconic president for Republicans. He's become what Roosevelt was for Democrats. And when George W. Bush sought the nomination for the presidency in 2000, he compared himself to Ronald Reagan. And we set out to say, okay, six, 7 years into it, let's see how he's done. And that's what we did. We examined that.
Lou Cannon, how do you begin to go about a project like that? Looking in the book, I was struck, for starters, just by approval ratings numbers. When Ronald Reagan left the White House, he had approval ratings between 63% and 68%, the highest for any president who's left office alive, you and Carl write. George Bush's are right now in the low 30s, the lowest of his presidency. Is that the measure, or paint the broader canvas for us? How do you start to compare these presidents?
Well, we didn't start with approval ratings, although they are certainly a measure. I think we started by trying to examine the proposition of why Reagan is this iconic figure first. We have a chapter in there called What Reagan Wrought. And then on a whole number of measures, the war, economic policy, judicial appointments, we try to specifically compare and say Reagan did this and George W. Bush did that, and why did it work? And we try to go a little bit beyond that because we examine the management styles of these two presidents, and that's part of the comparison.
Let's begin to jump into that. I mean, it's a fascinating comparison for a president who came in embracing the Reagan legacy and image so hard. Some may say, for the country at large, maybe Reagan's the right standard to compare against. Maybe he's not. Some Republicans these days, David Brooks recently, writing that it's time for Republicans to sort of move on and maybe find new models. But let's just take this comparison. Begin to walk us in, Carl. Where and how do you begin this comparison? How does George W. stack up?
Well, the first thing you do is you look at Iraq. The war in Iraq is what is responsible for those poll numbers you cited earlier, Tom. This is not a popular president, and this is not a popular war. And one of the things we wanted to do is ask ourselves, would Ronald Reagan have done this? The other thing, and other presidents too, not just Reagan. Mm-hmm. You know, those low approval ratings that you cited, Harry Truman left office in 1953, approval ratings in the low 30s or high 20s, widespread view in the country that he had led us into a foreign war that had no end in sight, and
Korea.
Corruption
mm-hmm.
and corruption in his own party. Mm. So, you know, we'll get to that in a minute. I mean, mm-hmm. sometimes you have to take the long view. But previous presidents, what they did and what they would have done is important. It's an exercise. You never really know. But one of the things my dad said is, you know, we've got to look at Woodrow Wilson. And we have a revisionist chapter on Wilson in there because people compare Bush to Wilson and as a criticism, both liberals and conservatives, by
the way.
That
is in Woodrow Wilson's determination to spread freedom and democracy around the world. That's a high ideology there.
That's right. Make the world safe for democracy, the war to end all wars. It's mm-hmm. that kind of messianic thinking that led us into World War One. Well, my dad persuaded me, and it's in the book, that we don't even think Woodrow Wilson would have invaded Iraq, let alone Ronald Reagan. So that's kind of I think that's how you start with Bush, is you look at Iraq.
Luke Cannon, take us into that comparison, that contrast, I guess, then. How do you go about holding George W. Bush's leadership into the Iraq War up against the legacy and record of Ronald Reagan?
Well, first of all, you look at the wars that were fought on each president's watch. Ronald Reagan was always loath to lose American troops in any endeavor. He fought. We fought a proxy war in Central America. Reagan was very much against committing U.S. troops to that conflict, even though he worried that the communists were going to take over the hemisphere. Mm. We fought a war in Grenada that was very, very a very small war, and in that, the Reagan administration insisted that we use extra force more than may have been needed to keep the casualties down. He had one very terrible thing that happened on his watch, the killing of those 240-some Marines who were in Lebanon as mm-hmm. part of a peacekeeping force. Reagan called that the saddest day of my presidency, the saddest day of my life.
And he pulled and U.S. troops right out of Lebanon.
And they weren't there to advance American might or purpose or policy. They were there as part of an international peacekeeping force. They were there with the French, who suffered grievous losses on the same day when their place they were holding, it wasn't a bunker, was blown up, and so. Though not only did he pull the troops out, but he never wanted to go back anywhere. There was a very heated argument in the last year of the Reagan administration, which we get into in detail in the book, that he should go into that he should send troops into Panama to snatch the dictator Manuel Noriega.
Right.
Reagan argued against it. Reagan said, "If you do that, we'll be seen as the Colossus of the North. Nobody will be forced. We're going to lose American troops, and we're going to kill civilians." And that's exactly what happened when the first George Bush did send troops in. Reagan wanted a deal to get Noriega out. Noriega would be spending his life in Spain now in presumed luxury. Reagan kept saying to his top advisors, James Baker and Ed Meese, that this is much preferable to getting American troops killed. So that Reagan was a resolute person. He stood up to the Soviet Union, but he was not ever cavalier with. I don't mean to say that George W. Bush is cavalier, but he was not ever careless in terms of putting American troops in harm's way.
Carl Cannon, in that case, how do you finally weigh the difference in perspective between these two presidents, Reagan and George W. Bush, the difference in perspective that took Ronald Reagan out of Lebanon, kept him out of Panama, but the difference that put George W. Bush into Iraq?
Well, Tom, that's the question we wrestled with. What you just said there is maybe the central question of the book. We don't think that there's a difference of perspective in terms of America's great calling in the world to spread freedom. We, in fact, you know, George W. Bush gets a lot of grief from this from our liberal friends who think that this line of his, freedom is not America's gift to the world, it's God's gift to every man and woman in the world. Well, that's very much in the rhetorical tradition of U.S. presidents, not just Ronald Reagan, but Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt and, in fact, Jefferson. It's an expression of natural rights. So there's not a difference of perspective on what is desirable in the world and what America's obligation and role is. The difference between George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, and, in fact, we think George W. Bush and most presidents, is this lack of this inability to see what's possible. Reagan's great genius was not charisma. The Peter Drucker said this, the management guru, but his ability to know what you could accomplish. And that seems to be what's missing from this administration, is this sense of realism and limits.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about George W. Bush's legacy through a particular prism, the legacy of the president he's most admired, Ronald Reagan. Lou Cannon and Carl Cannon are with us. They're co-authors of the new book, Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy. Lou Cannon covered Ronald Reagan for 36 years, first as a reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and later as White House correspondent for the Washington Post. He's written a lot, many books on Ronald Reagan, including President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. Carl Cannon is former White House correspondent for the National Journal, co-author of this book, also co-author of Boy Genius, Karl Rove, the architect of George W. Bush's remarkable political triumphs. Let's listen just a minute to compare these two a bit again. In his speech last night, President Bush reiterated his belief that money belongs in the hands of the people, not the government.
We must trust in the ability of free peoples to make wise decisions and empower them to improve their lives for their futures. To build a prosperous future, we must trust people with their own money and empower them to grow our economy.
There we go. Last night, President Bush in his State of the Union address. 20 years ago, in this same month, President Ronald Reagan spoke about how he had restored American influence and prestige on the world stage.
America was weak and freedom everywhere was under siege. Today, America is strong and democracy is everywhere on the move. From Central America to East Asia, ideas like free markets and democratic reforms and human rights are taking hold. We've replaced blame America with look up to America.
President Ronald Reagan, 20 years ago this month. Lou Cannon, let's look at those parting observations, or claims anyway, by President Reagan. Here he was facing his last year in office, and he said, America is strong. Democracy is everywhere on the move. Free markets, democratic reforms, human rights, all taking hold. We've replaced blame America with look up to America. Could George W. Bush honestly make that speech, those claims today, Lou?
Well, he could make some of them, although there's been ups and downs in a lot of places in the world on human rights and democracy. I saw the numbers the other day, Freedom Watch, or somebody did it, and there's still an impressive number of countries that grant more freedoms than they used to, or that are more democratic than they used to be. I think the harder part of that claim is about America's strength. We get into it in the book, perhaps not even as much as we should, but this war in Iraq, in addition to the controversy about whether or not we ought to be engaged in it, has really, really stretched our military, stretched the army, put us in a position where it may be extremely difficult to respond to other crises in the world, and we know there will be other crises, no matter whom the occupant of the White House is. And I think that we are not probably as strong as we ought to be because of the drain that the Iraq war has put. Obviously, the most important drain is on the lives and limbs of our fighting men and women, but it's also been an economic drain, and it's also put a lot of pressure on Army reenlistment, because we don't have a draft in this country. We have a volunteer Army.
And Carl Cannon, what about
some, yes, can please. I add something to
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
President Bush and Vice President Cheney believed, without ever directly criticizing Ronald Reagan, that the way the United States left Lebanon, which my dad talked about earlier, and also the way Bill Clinton left Somalia, and some of these, the last couple of presidents, well, specifically Clinton and Reagan, that they encouraged terrorism and they encouraged some of the jihadis and they encouraged some of a nation's enemies. And they've talked about this pretty directly. Well, the question you have to ask yourself then is, okay, but how about this, about what has happened in Iraq? Has this discouraged America's enemies? So I think this question of American strength is an important one. And it seems that President Bush has helped bring about what he most feared, which is he's in some ways emboldened America's enemies.
There's the question of sort of direct strength, but Ronald Reagan was also speaking there about American reputation, American image. He said in that line, "We've replaced blame America with look up to America." How about George W. Bush's legacy in those terms, Carl?
Well, it's interesting because in Washington, it's a de rigueur among Democrats and reporters and all my friends to say that our reputation, America's reputation abroad is shot and that we've never been more unpopular. And Pew does some polling that shows that we have taken a hit. But there's something a little curious is that every time there's an election abroad, it seems that the pro-American candidate wins. So I think that's a little more complicated than the Democratic candidates for president, let's say, led on. But there is simply no question that this initiative in Iraq and the stalled effort in Afghanistan squandered a lot of the pro-American feeling after 9/11. I just think there's a general feeling, not just in this country, but in the world, that America invaded perhaps the wrong country, or if not the wrong country, invaded a country that had not invaded America. I'm talking about Iraq, and has not finished the job. And cultures where strength is respected, we haven't really shown the strength because we haven't won. Cultures that are more pacifist, where diplomacy is respected, we have their view is we didn't negotiate. And so it just seems that what the moral authority of America that Reagan talked about has been diminished by this administration.
We've got to look more at the whys in the difference between these presidents, why the different paths we've ended up on, and more at the economy, I think. But I want to begin to bring our listeners in. Lou and Carl Cannon are with us. Their new book is Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy. And they're looking at these two presidents, one who modeled himself hard on the other, now that George W. Bush has entered his last year in office. Let's take a call from Atlanta, Georgia, and Joe. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
Panel. I just wanted to say that I voted for Bush both times. I'm almost ashamed to admit it now, and I was, I'm pushing 30 now. My dad raised me as a Reagan Republican. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember when George Bush ran, he ran on a lot of Reagan's policies, but everything sort of went in a tailspin, and it's this whole nation-building thing, which George Bush actually ran against, you know, that he's absolutely just become a slave to anymore. And it's, you know, you can tell it's bankrupting the country, and it's almost shameful, you know, to see where his presidency has gone.
Joe, where does that leave you thinking as a voting American today? Are you looking back to Reagan and hoping for a Republican candidate who tries to steer back there? Or are you trying to look forward to a new horizon? How are you thinking today?
Well, I kind of think it's interesting to see all these Republican candidates, you know, and watch The Daily Show where they show, you know, Romney and McCain and Giuliani and all these guys, Huckabee, even just going on and on about how Reagan-esque they actually are when, you know, in reality, you could look at the record of McCain and Romney, and you can see right away that they are not very Reagan-esque in a lot of their policies. And, you know, I have to say that the closest thing to it anymore is Ron Paul, who actually was a good, you know, Reagan Republican and was close to Ronald Reagan. But I just think no one really pays a whole lot of attention to this guy who's been consistently Republican. They laugh him off the stage, you know.
Joe, thanks very much for your call from Atlanta. Lou Cannon, how about it? The Republicans on the stump right now, grabbing onto that mantle of Ronald Reagan just about as hard as they can, most of them. You and Carl, draw some big distinctions between the sitting president and Ronald Reagan. What about Ronald Reagan and these would-be heirs today? Do you see them cut from the same cloth, Lou?
Well, in politics, as in many other endeavors in life, nothing succeeds like success. I've been writing about politics a long time, too long, a lot of people probably would say. And I saw a lot of people who were started out, people were going to be the next FDR, and then they were going to be the next JFK, and then they're going to be the next Reagan. And these kinds of people don't come along down the pike every day. There was only one FDR. There was only one JFK. There was only one Reagan. So, no, I think it's totally understandable why all of them are out there comparing themselves to Reagan. What do they want to be president? They want to. They're not going to compare themselves to somebody who's at 30% in the polls. They're not going to say I'm a Bush Republican. But I don't see Ronald Reagan in any of them, quite honestly, with the one exception. And I really appreciated the caller's comments, but I disagree on one point. I do see some of this, despite his support for the war. I see some of this in John McCain. There is a sort of a stalwart quality about McCain that and the Reagans liked him very much, and he had a genuine friendship with the Reagans. So I see a glimmer of that. But that said, he's very different than Ronald Reagan, and they all are.
Let's take a call from Fall River, Massachusetts, and Kevin. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. I think one way of comparing both presidents is to, as you know, one focal point of comparison would be their relationship to the neoconservatives. Reagan, evil empire, axes of evil with George Bush, similar rhetoric. Because of the post-Vietnam era, Reagan wasn't in a position to have large-scale troop deployments into a battle, but he had a lot of proxy wars going on, Angola, mm-hmm. Mozambique, Afghanistan,
Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm. Then, George, the father, the Powell Doctrine, and getting rid of what was referred to as the Vietnam Syndrome. But the neoconservatives weren't even satisfied with George the father because he exited from Iraq. So there was this bellicose, hard right-wing force power, I believe fantasy, when it's used exclusively, that George W. Bush has fallen under since 9/11. Now, Reagan was different in the sense of he looked into Gorbachev's eyes and saw a soul. Unlike Putin, Gorbachev actually had one, and Reagan met him halfway. He responded to the nuclear freeze movement.
Right.
He had this grandiose imagination, but he actually went beyond the neoconservatives and wasn't locked into their ideological straitjacket.
Kevin, let us pick it up. Carl Cannon, do you see, could Ronald Reagan have become a disciple of the neocons, or was there something constitutionally about that man who made him immune, where George W. Bush clearly was not, has not been?
Well, absolutely, there was. The caller, he's half right about Gorbachev and Putin, but the difference between what's going on today is not the difference between Gorbachev and Putin. It's the difference between Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. Reagan would have never said anything like, I look into his eyes and saw a soul. What he said when negotiating with the Russians was, trust but verify.
Quite different.
And the caller also spoke about the Powell Doctrine. Well, that's what we call it, but it's really the Weinberger Doctrine. It was developed while Reagan was president, in the aftermath of those horrific losses in Lebanon that my father spoke of, and they didn't want it to happen again. And
if you Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger,
if you look at, and he gave a speech at the National Press Club, and that caller or any of your other listeners can find it easily online. I did, and you, And he goes through about six criterion for invasion, including is there a clear goal? Is it attainable? You can look it up. I won't paraphrase it all. It's a long speech, but the Iraq invasion does not meet those criterion. So I don't think that Reagan would have been a neocon.
Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and Steve. Steve, you're on the air with Lou and Carl Cannon.
Yes, I'll be brief. You were talking about the differences between Reagan and Bush.
Yes.
One big difference between Bush and all the previous presidents is that Bush moved us from a defensive stance to a preemptive stance, and that's why some people outside this country consider Bush to be the most dangerous man in the world.
Including, Steve, thanks for that. Lou Cannon, including some conservatives. You quote Jeffrey Hart, the conservative, in the book, Reagan's Disciple, saying Bush is not a conservative. You've got William F. Buckley in the book defining conservatism as the politics of reality and saying that George W. Bush doesn't meet that standard, Lou.
Well, one thing, and I don't know this is in the defense of Bush, but the situation has changed in this respect. And it changed in part because of Ronald Reagan. As long as there was the threat to the United States and to its interest and to civilization was the Soviet nuclear forces, there was quite a bit of unity among conservatives and among Americans about the need to respond to that threat. And everybody didn't always agree on the way, but on the basic point, there was not fundamental disagreement. Now, with the Soviet Union gone, in part because of Ronald Reagan's efforts and Gorbachev's efforts, a lot of conservatives are sort of free to revert to an old-style isolationism, so that even if George W. Bush had not made the mistake, which I believe it to be, of launching a war in Iraq, I think you'd still have conservatives all over the map. I just want to add one thing to the previous comment of Carl, which I very much agree with. In our book, we quote the Jack Matlock, who was one of the people, a fluent Russian speaker, who helped prepare Reagan for his meetings with Gorbachev, and was afterwards our able ambassador to the Soviet Union. I was on the stage when this happened at Princeton. Jack Matlock was asked the question, what's the difference between the neoconservatives with Reagan and the neoconservatives with George W. Bush? And Matlock replied succinctly, Ronald Reagan used the neocons have used George W. Bush.
Carl Cannon, do you think that there will be any arguing that when history gets around to sorting out George W. Bush's legacy?
Well, sure. You know, there will be arguing that. We're writing this book now, and George W. Bush can be commander-in-chief for another year. If there are no attacks on this country again after 9/11, that will be part of his legacy. We don't know, you know, Tom, you and me and the voters are trying to judge Bush in part to know who to vote for this time. But historians will also want to know who came after George W. Bush and what happened. Harry Truman, who left office about the way Bush is leaving office, was rehabilitated 20 years later, in part because Richard Nixon was president. We came to appreciate Truman's directness. So we don't really know the end of the story.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about George W. Bush's legacy through a particular prism, the legacy of the president he has most admired, Ronald Reagan. Lou Cannon and Carl Cannon are with us. They're co-authors, father and son, longtime watchers of the White House, and in Lou's case, biographer many times over of Ronald Reagan. Their new book is Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy. Here's the president ending his speech last night, his last State of the Union speech, with his hopes for the country after he leaves office.
By trusting the people, succeeding generations transformed our fragile young democracy into the most powerful nation on earth and a beacon of hope for millions. And so long as we continue to trust the people, our nation will prosper, our liberty will be secure, and the state of our union will remain strong.
George W. Bush last night. He came in. He was called Reagan's heir, even Reagan's son. Is that the right measure? And how does he stack up by it? Carl is calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Carl. You're on the air with Lou and Carl Cannon.
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for your show.
Sure.
Say, you know, the two things those two administrations have in common, they left us with a huge debt. Let's say, for instance, Ronald Reagan and two administration and Bush left us with $3 trillion in debt. On this president, George W. Bush, going to end up with $3.5 trillion in debt in 7 years.
It's a big pile.
Can you imagine?
It is a very big pile. Let us look at that. It's a good point. Lou Cannon, how about the record on the fiscal front that these two presidents left behind nearly now?
Well, it's superficially similar, but it's substantively different, I think, also. In Reagan's case, although we weren't losing troops in any prolonged war, we were spending a lot of money on the Cold War. The Cold War was mostly not a shooting war, but it was a very, very costly war. And we have run deficits in every war we've had in this country. And after the end of the Cold War, which occurred under first President Bush's watch, there was a substantial reduction. Some people would say there was too much of a reduction, but there was a substantial reduction in military spending that would not have been possible without the end of the Cold War, and that in turn led to balanced budgets during the Clinton years. Now the Democrats will say that was President Clinton, and the Republicans will say that's the Republican Congress. Well, whoever it was, or if it was both of them, you couldn't have had that happen without I hate to use the word peace dividend because that's been so overused, but you couldn't have had it if the wartime deficits of the Cold War had remained. So while the direct legacy of Reagan certainly was an unbalanced budget and a lot of debt, and we don't give him a pass on that. It's not quite the same. Now somebody's going to turn around and say, well, there may be a huge a beneficial legacy of this guy's debt too. I must say I don't see that, but it's different. It's not just a number on a page that's important in evaluating this.
Carl Cannon, how do you compare these fiscal records? I mean, another big difference is Ronald Reagan had a Democratic Congress throughout, but George Bush was leading a country and leading, by party affiliation, a Republican Congress for the vast majority of his time in office. He has. Does that make his record look different?
Well, it turned out to be part of the problem. I don't disagree with anything my dad said, but part of the Republican mantra now, and this goes for – this is one of the few things Bush and these Republicans in Congress all agreed on, is if you cut taxes, it'll spur the economy. This was known as the Laffer curve when Reagan introduced the world to it in 1980 after Art Laffer, a USC economist. And it's true to a point. At some point, it no longer becomes true, like most maxim. But look, they're all supply-siders now, and that's very much Reagan's legacy. So I don't give George W. Bush a pass on this, but I blame Reagan in part for it as well.
But now we've got, I was reading New York Times columnist David Brooks recently, in a column where he says, you know, supply-side economics had a good run, but continual tax cuts can no longer be the centerpiece of Republican economic policy. And Brooks is a fairly conservative columnist. He says Republicans are groping for a new economic model. Economic policies are shifting. Is Ronald Reagan himself out of date at this point as the kind of icon on the economic front, Carl?
Well, David Frum wrote this before David Brooks did. They're friends.
Yep.
And Frum worked in the Bush White House, was a speechwriter. It was there a brief time. But you know what? These Republicans, they do need to find something new. And I don't think they're invoking Ronald Reagan so much because of his policies, but rather because of his persona, because as my dad said, he was a winner. He ran for re-election. He won 58% of the vote. He carried 49 states. He stitched together this disparate coalition of libertarian conservatives like our friend who called in and likes Ron Paul and the religious conservatives like the Huckabee people. Reagan did that effortlessly. So they're reaching for that mantle. But they make a mistake in wanting to just do Reagan's policies. You played a clip earlier, Tom, of President Bush talking about the economy, and I noticed I kind of laughed when you said it, when I heard it, because he said to grow the economy. He used that verb. Well, Bill Clinton used that. You've got to use new material. They need new ideas.
I guess everybody these days, right across party lines. George is calling from Sumter, South Carolina. George, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was right after the Reagan era moved from South Carolina out to Utah, and I saw the difference in what had happened here in South Carolina with keeping our gas prices low, which Ronald Reagan did, and how a lot of the economies out west were just destroyed by what he did. Little towns like Price, Utah, and other places in Texas where they had a boom with oil and uranium and other things like that, and they were just destroyed. People were coming in applying for minimum wage jobs with me that had been making $25 and $30 an hour, you know.
So on economic performance, how do you compare the two presidents, George?
Well, here in South Carolina, Ronald Reagan was just wonderful. And out west, he didn't do very well, but it's exactly...
I guess he did all right by California, if you look at that west, but you mean maybe Mountain West.
Well, I'm talking about Texas and Utah. Like here in South Carolina, I mean, he was great. He kept he kept the oil prices fuel prices low, and everything was just going great here. But out there, they were just destroyed in some little small places. And the exact opposite thing is happening now. We're being destroyed here in South Carolina by these ridiculous high prices on gas and fuel oil and stuff like that, where they're having boom towns in Texas that were the exact same towns that were dying back then are coming back and having tremendous boom.
George, where does that leave you looking in the current Republican race or outside it? Are you still looking at a Republican candidate, a Democrat? Who?
I think it's terrible that we're over here fighting a war. I really believe it's to pump up gas prices.
So when John McCain says we must hang in there, what do you say to that, George?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, we've already gotten into a muck, and we can't just really back out of it and leave those people to fend for themselves. I mean, they, you know, obviously need us at this point, and we've got to stay with them as far as that goes.
Rocking a hard place you're describing right there. We thank you for your call, George. Thanks a lot. From Halifax, Vermont, Kermit is calling. Hi, Kermit. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well.
There's a big comparison I can make between Bush and Reagan, and that's that we had the Iran-Contra affair that everyone seems to forget about now.
And in Ronald Reagan's last year in office, if the investigations had gone deeper, who knows, he might have been impeached himself.
Right, and we have this, you know, the big corporate interest, the laissez-faire of Reagan's time, and now we have Bush. Bush might be, you know, remembered as the least favorite president the Americans have ever had, but in 20 years, we're going to have, everyone's going to forget about it, and the big corporate interests are, you know, still completely intact and flourishing.
So you see both men as having pushed those interests. Carl, what do you say to Kermit?
Well, I'll quote Churchill, who said that democracy and capitalism are the worst systems ever devised, except for all the others.
Except that they've been practiced in different ways by different presidents, as you and your father point out. The income gap in this country has certainly not always been what it has become in the time since Ronald Reagan and through George Bush.
Well, a serious answer is that both of these presidents we've talked about, and in fact, the two presidents who came between them, George Bush's father and Bill Clinton, were always trying to balance their sort of Silicon Valley side of their brain, where it's just unfettered American entrepreneurship, with the other side of their brain, which is that the people who aren't getting help need it and that corporations need to be regulated. There was very little antitrust has gone out the window during Clinton's administration. This administration cut taxes for the top income people. President Reagan, at a trip I was on in the mid-80s, said we should do away with the corporate tax altogether. I think this is something the president struggled with. And I also think it's something that Barack Obama talks about extensively. He seems to have his finger on the pulse of people like this caller and others who think the pendulum has swung too far towards a corporate laissez-faire attitude.
Lou Cannon, you watched Ronald Reagan very closely. What about it? On this facet, at least, is it possible that George W. Bush stayed on the Reagan beam too long, rode that right over a cliff? Maybe the example is the subprime mess that's, you know, just killing the economy right now. People say that's because there was too little oversight of American banking.
Well, Tom, I grew up in an age where Herbert Hoover was blamed for everything except sunspots. I don't think that with as critical as I am of George W. Bush, that he's necessarily blamed for the housing crisis. In this country, somebody once said that we have a secret yearning for a king, and we attribute to the presidents all the good things and bad things that are happening. The caller before last was talking about, I thought that his comments were very interesting, about how South Carolina boomed and Mountain West towns shriveled up. And I don't know that you can trace these in a straight line to the policies of Reagan or Bush.
Ronald Reagan certainly picked up a smaller government, less government line. It was a central theme of his presidency, and George Bush certainly embraced it. I mean, we've had economist after economist come on this show and say, and indeed make the connection between too little oversight, big problems in the financial markets, and now global economic challenges as a result. But you don't see any.
Well, what I'm saying is that it's something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Reagan, the phrase that the Reaganauts put on what Reagan did was the Reagan Revolution.
Yes.
And both sides largely accepted that. But the truth is there were very, very little fundamental that changed in the economic system of the country. George Will once said that Americans are conservative. What they want to conserve is the New Deal. And we now know from the Reagan diaries and from other documents that Reagan was very specific. He did want to conserve the New Deal. What he didn't want to conserve was Lyndon Johnson's The Great Society. I think that the global economic changes that have occurred, the pressure on energy use from the competition of China and the emergent and India, these phenomena which have changed and are changing our lives and are going to continue to change our lives would have happened no matter who was in the White House.
And now it's all about how the country responds to those challenges.
Yes.
Carl Cannon, you and your father in the book Reagan's Disciple cite a big piece that Bill Keller, now executive editor of the New York Times, wrote all the way back in January of 2003. Where he talked a lot about George Bush as Reagan's son was the subheadline of his piece there. He quotes Bush people and Reagan people saying at that time, including Michael Deaver, saying that, you know, Bush, yeah, he looks a lot like Ronald Reagan in many ways. His conclusion was that he said in conclusion of that piece, if Bush fails, my guess is that it will be a failure not of caution but of overreaching, which means it will be failure on a grand scale. Here we are much further through that presidency of George W. Bush. Where are we headed? Are we headed toward that grand scale failure in your view, Carl, or somewhere else?
Well, I think a majority of the voters have already come to that conclusion. And I think that if you ask them to put one word on the grand failure, that word would be Iraq.
And it brings us back to the fundamental difference between these two men that led George Bush there and not Ronald Reagan to that kind of quagmire. Lou Cannon, take us back to the heart of things, if you can. How again, do you see the fundamental difference? What is it that you think took George W. there but kept Ronald Reagan off of that kind of rocky path?
At the risk of contradicting myself, which I do often, I think that presidents can do a lot less about the economy than most people suppose, but they are decisive on the issue of war and peace. They choose. I know we have a constitution where the Congress is supposed to declare war, but but in practice, it's the presidents who decide. The president who decides that we go into Korea or into Vietnam or into Lebanon or into Iraq. And I think that what is missing from George W. Bush that Ronald Reagan had in abundance is it goes back to the Drucker quote that Carl was quoting. Reagan had a sense of what we could accomplish and not accomplish. He was an enormously practical person. Yes, he was an ideological conservative, but he knew that there were limits to American power. It was almost like it was part of his DNA. He understood that, and I think that is the great weakness of George W. Bush. I don't think he's a bad person, and I think some of these policies there may be a reappraisal on, but I think he has no innate sense, and he didn't have the advisors whom he listened to who
could give it to him. With that, we're out of time. The book is Reagan's Disciple, Lou and Carl Cannon. Thank you very much for your time. This is On Point.